County's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh on the programme with you this morning. It's a Friday, which means we have our Friday panel. I'll introduce you to the panel in just a moment. Later on, we'll have our entertainment slot. Michael Eddy will be in studio along with the redoubtable Katie McGee, and they'll be giving us their recommendations and discussing some of the things that are on TV and your streaming services and in the cinema and on the stage at the moment. That's all coming up after 11, but a lot to get through before that. Don't forget, by the way, if you want to get in touch with the programme, you can do so. 086-6025000 for your text messages or your WhatsApp messages. You can call us, of course, on 074-9125000. That number, 00353749125000 if you're calling from outside the dialing area. Shannon taking your calls, as is Caroline, and Caroline producing the programme this morning as well. We're also on social media. We're at Highland Radio on X. We're Highland Hub on Facebook, and you can interact with us there. You can also watch the show unfold. As I say, we have one of our guests in studio. We have two on Zoom for the panel. We'll have other guests in studio, and of course Michael and Katie will be in studio as well later on. You can watch all that unfold on your screens. We're on Facebook, Highland Radio Ireland. No, we're on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, and we're on Facebook, Highland Radio, and also Highland Radio News and Sport page as well. So there are plenty of opportunities with which you can interact with us today. I want to introduce you to our panel. First of all, in studio with me, sitting in front of me, is Hugh Friel, Men's Development and Health Worker with the Donegal Traveller Project. Hugh, good morning.
Good morning, Don. How are you?
And then looking toward Zoom, joining us on Zoom, we have Emma McGrath, who is a teacher and co-director of the McGrath School of Speech and Drama. Emma, good morning.
Good morning, Donald. Good morning, gentlemen.
And also Brendan Byrne, the CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters, and also, of course, a former member of Donegal County Council and indeed a former mayor of this fair county. Brendan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Donald. Good morning, everyone.
Pleasure to have all three of you with us. Now, obviously, one of the big topics of conversation today is the Leaving Cert. And the results going out today, they'll be online from 10. Schools will start giving out the results over the course, I presume, of the next hour. A lot of people having a lot of decisions to face. They'll be anxiously waiting CAO offers next week. But let's talk about the CAO and the whole rigmarole that people have to go through now. And it's the same now as it was when I was going through it back in 1981 when I did my Leaving Cert, probably before some of our panellists were born, if the truth be told. In fact, I'm fairly sure it was at least before one of our panellists was born. I can't speak for the other two, and I'm not going to say which, but I think everyone knows exactly what I'm saying here. But, I mean, the process is still very much the same. You get your Leaving Cert results, then a few days later the CAO offers come out, and you then get the scramble to try and get college places. Maybe the big difference between when I was going through the system and now is accommodation wasn't the monumental nightmare that it is at the moment, and there's a lot of discussion to be had on that over the course of the coming weeks. But I want to start just with the whole process as it begins. Emma, I'm going to go to you first as a teacher, someone who is an educator. Is there a better way of doing this? Is there a way we could do this that would perhaps take the stress off the students and off their families?
I definitely think it has to be looked at. As you say, it hasn't changed in several decades. I remember the fear waking up this morning 21 years ago and hoping that those magic numbers were going to be on my piece of paper. Unfortunately, it didn't work out that way for myself, but there are scenic routes available, and I think that definitely has to be promoted as a more viable option. You know, looking at some statistics this week, it was saying that 80% of secondary school students aspire to go to college, but because of, I guess, the step up from secondary school to third level, only 65% of those actually see through those courses, and that other 15% drop out. The way we assess our students through the Leaving Cert, I know there has definitely been changes at the junior circle and there has been a reform cycle introduced, but, you know, the third level system is definitely constructed through a linguistic ability. You know, you're encouraged to use words, to be able to have very high developed auditory skills. And sometimes that isn't just everybody's method of learning. And that's definitely something we look at primary level. We try to teach to people's learning methods, whether it's auditory, whether it's tactile, whether it's visual. But that doesn't suit everyone. You know, you may, this meme pops up every so often, you know, if we assess everybody with how to climb a tree, not everyone's going to, you know, a fish can't climb a tree. So therefore they're always going to think that they're incapable, or to quote Einstein, that they're stupid. You know, it's not one size fits all. It definitely doesn't work. I do feel that the UCAS system has a lot of merit, because it's a more broader and more encompassing system in order to assess a student's ability to go to college and to see are they the right fit for that course, because it takes different stages. You know, you have to, you know, your work experience, your voluntary experience, your personal assessment or your personal statement, your reference from an credible individual, or maybe you're a teacher at school, all holds weight and worth when it goes to your assessment to place you in that college course. And then obviously your grades accompany that when they come out. So it's definitely a more maybe holistic approach, as opposed to do you get the numbers? Do you fit it? No. Yes, no. Computer says no.
My own daughter went to college in Cardiff, and indeed she travelled over to Cardiff. I think it was about 2 months before the leaving cert, if I recall correctly. She actually travelled over, did an interview, had a conversation with the people that run the course that she was doing, and she had a walk around the college, and then she got the offer. The offer came after the results and all that came out. But I mean, she had a fairly clear idea that she would get the course if she got certain results. And it certainly was the picture you got there was that her interview and their take on her formed part of that overall decision. It wasn't just you didn't get this person got 560, that person got 540, therefore the person who got 560 is going to get the place, the person who got 540 isn't, or whatever the numbers may be. Brendan, I want to go to you as someone who's involved in politics. I mean, you've been observing this as a politician, and I know you keep a very close eye on national as well as local politics. Successive ministers, Norma Foley at the moment, Joe McHugh before her, other ministers in the past have looked at this, and they've all tried to grapple with this situation. How do we make the whole results and college process easier? Politically, what do you believe can be done and should be done?
Well, I suppose it's 32 years since I sat my leaving cert, and I still have a recollection of every minute of every exam. But if you just review leaving certs in general, you know, the combination of 13 years of primary and secondary education, of 14 years as quick case can be, and it all boils down to a 3-hour exam. And, you know, if you compare us and contrast us to other countries such as America or the UK, we are now out of kilter. There was a time that the leaving cert was a very fine exam and an exam certification to have, but it's outdated. Now, the problem you're going to have at political level is you're going to have massive upheaval in order to change what we have into what's a modern exam. Now, it's very difficult for anyone to justify 13, 14 years of education boiling down to a solitary exam or two exam papers of 3 to 5 hours. It's totally unfair, and it doesn't reflect the robustness of the education system that we have at primary or secondary level. So your question was, what do we do? Well, the first thing we need to do is we need to get into our minds that this is to change, because half the population said, yeah, well, I sat the leaving cert. It served its purpose. It's a robust, it's a good examination. That is all correct in its time, but times change. And for us to be here in this discussion 40, 50 years after the core of the Leaving Cert papers were established, saying that we're still sitting by and large the same paper, the curriculums have changed, but the paper structure is still the same, is pretty unbelievable. So obviously, it's going to take a lot of discussion with teachers' unions, the department, and the political arm of the state. But it has to change. And it has to change to a continual assessment from junior cycle right through to leaving cert. And it has to be based on one more than one solitary exam.
And does there need to be contact between CAO and the students before the bald offer letter comes 3 days after? As Emma said, the UCAS system in the UK seems to be more holistic. Do we need to be taking a similar approach here with the CAO?
Well, if you look at what's happening here, well, some schools do send their students to colleges to get a feel of what third level life is. But by and large, that is not the case. And we have a complete disconnect between secondary level and third level. And Emma spoke to the fact that third of our students fall out of the system in the first year. Well, I think part of that problem is that we haven't connectivity at all between secondary level and third level. Mm-hmm. And there are students, and I was one of them, that went into a course that, in hindsight, I had no business in the course at all, because I was probably better suited to multiple other courses that I didn't quite know or grasp at the time, because I was leaving a secondary school in Carrick into UCD. So there is an entire discussion to be held here, but I'll tell you, it's more than a discussion. This needs to change. And then from that also, there's a lot that needs to change at third level too. Because if you look at the global rankings for universities for the last 10 years, year on year, Ireland is slipping. So we were once the gold standard of third and secondary level education. That's all slipping away from us. And there's an inertia and a fear to change. There's nothing to be feared from change.
In studio is Hugh Friel, the immense development and health worker with the Donegal Traveller Project. Hugh, you have, I'm sure, a very different take on this, because we're talking about the Leaving Cert and college almost in a way that, that presumes people will go to college. Yeah. Your community, your experience. Now, we know your son, David, has gone through college. He's got a degree. He's got a master's. He's a lecturer. He's doing his PhD. The sad reality is, when it comes to the travelling community, David is very much the exception. The norm is very, very different.
Yeah, certainly, like, it's like an alien world, I suppose, for the traveller community, in the sense of us achieving to get to third level. And I agree with the two other speakers there in relation to like the pressure of young students heading to college. Now, I know that the ATU and Letterkenny, they've opened days in relation to students coming there and getting the feel of the college life, but it's a very, I suppose, difficult place for any student, and not all students have the same learning ability as every other person. So my individual needs is different to somebody else's individual needs, and it can be very pressurising, I suppose, in the sense for parents and the students. But going back to our community, my community, that, you know, the education strategy was launched, the Traveller Education Strategy was launched there a few weeks ago in relation to traveller education, and the deprivement of travellers in the education system. We have little to few heading on to college or experience in that life. And certainly it was a new world for myself and my wife, when David got his Leaving Cert results to go to college, because we really didn't know what to do. In the sense, because he was the first in our family and our both sides to go to college, so this was a new era for us, a new stepping stone, and how to do that and how to process that and what supports are there, because not the Susie grant, and there's different supports, but it's really pressurising for parents, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, looking at Derry or looking going to Dublin or looking to go to Galway, and it's a new adventure for the student or the person who wants to avail of that. But there comes a whole load of lists of pressures with that, when somebody's awarded their points, or they might want to go to Dublin or to Galway or to different, or to Cork, or to go to England. So this, not alone the individual, the student, but the parents have an awful burden of pressure. Financial pressure, and then pressure of their child leaving home as well. You know, what's going to happen? It's a new world. It's a new era for that young person to leave as well. So you have all the anomalies happening as a parent, and then the student waiting on the results, your son or daughter waiting on the results. That is very, very stressful for them. You can see it in them. You can see, and the depreciation of the point system. It's like if you get 350 points and somebody else, your friend, gets 550 points, that alone degrading process of saying that you weren't good enough in the same exam as another individual. Now, I know, look, we have to tier, I suppose, in some kind of sense, but I think that could be done more appropriately because of the point systems around how good you are. You know, if you get 500 and some points, you can qualify for this or that, A, B or C. If you get 300 points really, or 400 points, you're really on the lower spectrum. Do you know what I mean? So I think it's a very unfair process for students, because we know the mental health of students out there. We know that, you know, within my community, the suicide rate is 7 times higher. You know, so it's a new thing for, I suppose, my community, college. Yeah. It's definitely a new thing for the travel community.
I remember reading once the meaning of the word education, educare, the Latin, it means to draw out. Mm. And part of what education means is to take the raw talent that's within each individual and to draw that raw talent out. And I strongly suspect within members of the travelling community in particular, there are many members of the community that have the raw talent, that have the intelligence, that have the ability, but they're not, the way the system is structured, it's just not being drawn out of them. And they're going through life with no one really realising or understanding or appreciating what their potential is.
Yeah, I think, look, it's well recognised that travellers and the education system, the education system has failed the traveller community in relation to, you know, to young travellers who are going from primary school, heading into secondary school, and the assessment in secondary school is then they can't hardly read or write. Now, who didn't pick that up? If the child goes to school on a daily basis, there's something morally wrong, you know, institutionally wrong. We're not blaming teachers here. We're not blaming, you know, we're saying that the institute itself, the Education Institute, there's something morally wrong. The discrimination or racism that's embedded in the walls and that around regarding my community, the Traveller community, going to school every day, are not making a real potential in terms of heading. Education's everything in life. If you've no education, you know, you're deprived of money, your health, your accommodation, your employment status, your existence in terms of community status. So there's a lot of things there that if your education disadvantage that affects, I suppose, your way in life. And I think that's if the conversation changes. And I was talking to a good few friends of mine. David's a lecturer in the ATU at the moment, and he's a lecturer in social care and law. And I was saying, like, imagine him, people going back and saying, Daddy, Mommy, my teacher's a traveller.
Mm-hmm.
That changes the dynamics of the conversation around the table, instead of saying the anti-stuff about travellers around the table and saying, oh, did you see the Rockwood Road, those gypsies are down the road, or Daddy, Daddy. No, Mommy, David Friedle's a lecturer. He lectures social care on me. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So these kind of potential employment statuses also changes the lay of the land in terms of relationships with the wider community.
Mm. And I suppose really equality is going to be when the fact that David Friedle is lecturing is like, yeah, whatever, so what? I mean, you know, yeah, he's a lecturer, he's a traveller,
so
what?
He shouldn't be
he is at the moment, David is still, and I know David is held up with huge respect, but one of the reasons he's being held up with huge respect is he is at the moment the only one. Emma, I want to go back to you because you've just indicated there the points that you were making is effectively the pressures that are there today are pressures that potentially began many, 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 many years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose this is your pathway, your narrative in life, and how we expect our children to succeed. The pressures put on, you know, maybe in generations gone past, parents haven't gone to third level college, so therefore the expectation is we're going to give our children every chance to do that. Maybe that's not the pathway that their child needs. Maybe we need to look at further education opportunities, apprenticeships. That needs to be something that needs to be, you know, really taken with more seriousness and given more weight in this country. But I just wanted, you know, a great respect for Hugh and his son David and all he has achieved, and having gone through the third level process for a degree and master's and further on, I know the level of commitment it takes. But I just want to refute the point that he makes regarding the inequality in education for the likes of the traveller community. You know, education has never been more equal at a primary setting in particular, and I can only speak for that as that's the setting that I teach in. I teach in a large urban school, almost 650 students, over between 40 to 50 nationalities. Irish travellers are one ethnicity within that. And education is as equal as it has ever been. Every child coming through that door now next week are going to have their books supplied for them. They have hot meals supplied. They have lunch provided or a snack in the morning. So the opportunity is there for children to learn at the same level if the support is offered from the home environment, if the attendance is there, if the children present for school. Even if a child presents to school 20 minutes late every day of the week, that soon amounts up, as you can imagine. Do the maths, do that over 180 odd days in the year. You're then soon missing really valuable hours, days, weeks of a child's educational journey. So, you know, the opportunity is there. Teachers have never been more, you know, we're always looking for more resources. We're always looking for better funding. We can always do with that. But with what we have, I have to say the profession is working to its pinned to its collar to do the best they can for every child, whether they're Irish, whether they're born in Letterkenny, whether they were born in Africa or Eastern European children that come through our doors. That opportunity is there, but you know, it's a community effort. It takes a village, doesn't it? Isn't that what they say?
Yeah.
You know, that we are there to do it, but it's the parents are their primary educators, and I guess together we work in tandem to do that.
David? Do you want to respond to that?
Oh, no, I can understand what she's alluded to there. And I think her passion and drive around equality is what we need in the system. That's not my experience with numbers of teachers or numbers of principals I've met in terms of their discriminative practice towards the members of the traveller community. And also the expectations of a lot of the education system in terms of the traveller community, because they want sometimes that travellers are going to drop out, or think that they're going to drop out, or they're going to marry young, or these stereotypical views. And I do agree where, look, there's a lot of effort on the parents as well that have to contribute to their children's education and ensuring that their child's at school, ensuring that they're meeting with the teachers in relation to their education progression. But it is well recognised nationally. We developed a national traveller education strategy. That's not made on the back of because there was equality. That was made on the back because there's an inequality in the education system in terms of the traveller community. But there is a lot of teachers out there who are really passionate, who are really driven by equality to ensure that the children come out with the same education attainment as their peers in the classroom. But that's not the case in every school or every classroom.
Well, hopefully, as Emma said, the situation is changing, and between the strategy and the drive toward equality in schools, I mean, you know, the situation hopefully will continue to get better, and hopefully in a few years' time, David Friel won't be the exception, he'll be the rule. This is the 9 to Noon Show on Highland Radio. It's our Friday panel. On the panel this morning, we have Emma McGrath, teacher and co-director of McGrath School of Speech and Drama. We have Hugh Friel, who's men's development and health worker with Donegal Traveller Project, and we have Brendan Byrne, who is the CEO of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters. And Brendan, it's you I want to go to now, if I may, because what's developed this week is a very interesting national conversation. It's an issue that's been discussed an awful lot in the Chamber of Donegal County Council, particularly in the context of the development plan, but also in general council discussions, both at MD and plenary council level. But it appears to be hitting the headlines this week, and that's the residential zoned land tax, and in particular the provision that anyone who owns land that is zoned for development will be charged an annual tax of 3% on that land's value, even if they are an active farmer who is farming the land and has no intention of actually selling it. I'm sure you've been watching this one with interest, Brendan. What's your take on the situation? Are we effectively creating a new urban-rural divide here?
Well, I think since the day this tax was first mooted, which I think is about four budgets ago, I think it's a complete nonsense. If you look at the situation in terms of housing that we have in this country since 2012, post-crash, we have a dysfunctional market where we cannot meet the supply and demand of the people. And imposing a tax in such a situation from an economic perspective is never going to solve anything. It's adding to the cost. Now, this was mooted initially as populism, that it would free up land almost instantly. And over the last 3 years, I assume the department are working on how to implement such a tax. But if you're going to bring in a tax, a new tax, you'd ask yourself, what does it achieve? Now, the theory behind this tax is that if you tax the land hard enough, you'll get it into development and therefore you'll solve the housing crisis. But what is the housing crisis in Ireland? The housing crisis in Ireland is a shortage of supply and in the labour sector, where physically we are struggling to build the number of houses that's needed in this country. So to be focusing our energy on a new tax as if it's going to solve anything is nonsensical.
The argument is, as you touched on, the argument behind this tax is that there are some people who own land, which is prime land for development, could be used to build houses, particularly in urban areas and larger cities, but they're holding onto that land in the hope that the value of the land will increase and they can sell it for more money next year than they might get for it this year. So the government's idea is put a 3% tax on it as a disincentive to hoard. And it was even, I noticed, in the Independence coverage all this week, it's being referred to as the hoarder's tax. The problem in Donegal and in other rural counties is Donegal County Council, as have other counties, has zoned some land on the outskirts of town, like Buncrana or Letterkenny or Carndonagh, as opportunity, I think is the phrase to use. It's opportunity. But that means that land is zoned for development, which means even if that's a family farm that's being farmed by a family who have no intention of selling it and no intention of doing anything with it, they are now subject to a 3% tax on the basis that they are hoarding land that could be used for development. And that's where the injustice is being perceived. Certainly looking at the commentary yesterday and today between the Greens, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, this is now looking like the sort of issue that may drive the final permanent wedge between the Greens and the two other parties.
Yeah, look, I accept the principle of land hoarding, and that would apply in Dublin 4, perhaps, or Dublin 6. But if you look at any development plan anywhere in Ireland, there is 100% of the land that is zoned for housing or potential housing, you're very lucky if 8 to 12% of that will be developed in the course of the development plan. So councils correctly zone more land than is needed in order to keep a constant supply. That's the theory of the development plan if you're doing it right. So this, I've always said this tax is a nonsense. You need to address the fundamentals. of economics if you have a shortage in your cycle. The shortage here is housing supply. It's because of labour. And we haven't addressed that. We're struggling to get back to the point whereby we're meeting the demand of the people. We're nearly there, but we're still a third off the benchmark. And I think focusing any energy on this tax is nonsense. It's populism and it's nonsensical. Focus on getting your supply right. That will mean you need to look at the labour shortages that are there. Anyone that's listening to this radio show this morning, if they're trying to get a renovation done or if their son or daughter is trying to build a house, know what I'm talking about. You cannot get a builder. You cannot get a roofer. You cannot get a plumber. And until we correct that, we ain't going to be building houses to the number and percentage that we need. And this is a nonsense, this tax. The theory of it, as you correctly said, Donald, came from land hoarding, which was very much prevalent around the commuter belt of Dublin. But that's a different issue to what you would have in Burncrona, Carn, Donagh, or Donegal town, or Ballyshannon, Bundoran, where they have town plans. And one size won't fit all here. But we are choosing to ignore the elephant in the room. We have a dysfunctional economy that doesn't have the infrastructure and the skills needed to supply houses.
Emma, a lot of people I'm sure you know are in the process of trying to build or building or trying to acquire housing. For young people in today's world, particularly those maybe in their mid to late 20s, heading into their 30s, for some, the idea of land, of a home ownership is almost an impossible dream. It must be an issue that young people are looking on with great interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do have a lot of friends, a lot of colleagues that are currently lucky enough to be, I guess, in the process to be building their own homes. But it hasn't came without its strife and its worries. And it's obviously its financial burden that is now going to be with them for the next 30 years. I was fortunate enough to purchase a house best part 10 years ago. And so this building crisis that's going on at the moment, I'm not in the midst of it. But as I say, I do have colleagues that are. And I guess we are predominantly rural based in Donegal. Yeah. So, you know, my thoughts are that maybe more initiatives and more support needs to be given there to support people to build in rural areas, you know, that the planning restrictions and implications, you know, could take that and bear that in mind. I do appreciate that there is, you know, there's incentives from the council regarding the costs that have been waived, you know, development fees and water charges, connection fees anyway, have been waived and have been extended in this past year up until the end of 2024. However, you know, it's still a huge, the hidden costs. I was doing a bit of research on this week as well. Think the hidden costs if you need to bring ESB, you know, to connection to your a rural site, the cost of a digger, laying lines, putting in poles, if you have to put it into neighbour's land, you know, maybe you haven't got access to water facilities. Water isn't connected to the site that you may want to build in a more rural area of Donegal. You know, perhaps something no more than the labour crisis, which feeds back into the CEO, as we spoke about earlier, and maybe more needs to be put on the value of apprenticeships in order to help that and boost it over the next 3 to 4 years. But maybe the likes of, you know, Ishka Aaron needs to be on board more with the fast tracking of water treatment plants in order to be able to facilitate rural areas, rural towns and villages in order for more economical and sustained development to happen, as opposed to focusing constantly on the urban setting. People in Donegal love living in Donegal. You know, if you go away to Dublin, if you go to Belfast, any other, they want to come back. They want to live here. But the opportunity to buy their own home or build even on their own family land has proven to be more and more difficult. And we need to do things to support that.
Hugh, are we in a situation where people in Dublin are looking at a Dublin problem and they're trying to impose a solution that's going to have an effect everywhere else in the country that has nothing to do with the problem in a way?
Like if you look at the residential kind of zoned land in Dublin that has been hoarded in the government's eyes in relation to potential landowners. So if you're concur what he said in relation to, you know, it's madness. If a land in Dublin's worth 20 million and a land in Donegal's worth 100,000, you're taxed the same tax bracket in theory. So I think that the elephant in the room is the housing crisis, really. And, you know, that we should be putting more of an emphasis on the housing crisis than we are on the taxes of lands and forcible sales within for landowners or farmers and zoned areas. And you know, if we look at the potential of, you know, social housing, private development housing, that we should be going down that avenue. We have a housing crisis and we put more of an emphasis on the housing, the elephant in the room, and the government should look of different initiatives in different ways, because it's got worse. If we look at the homelessness in Donegal alone, it's massive. You know, the council at the moment can't really handle the vast amount of people becoming homeless, getting termination letters because of the developers are moving in and buying private properties. People have no other option. Living, we're talking about house owners. We're also talking about people who are on the lower spectrum of renting, private rented, who have no other options, you know, to go to Donegal County Council and say, I'm homeless, can't get no other private rented facilities in the county. Like, if we look at them sectors alone in Donegal, no mind building, you know, an aspect of residential or zoned lands. You know, so we have a massive, massive crisis here that we need to be addressing quickly and swiftly in relation to acquiring land and acquiring social housing.
And a number of comments coming in, and thanks indeed for that, Hugh. And this agrees with you, I think, here. Land acquisition aside, what about utilities for said development areas? Am I wrong in saying Letterkenny struggles at the moment to meet with water needs? What happens when there are more areas to serve? That certainly is the situation, and we know from speaking to various councillors there are serious water issues in parts of Letterkenny. I mean, I'm thinking of the area around Bumney, New Mills, that whole Rasheedock area. That, I mean, you know, there's a huge water crisis there at the moment. Caller says, I live in rural Donegal and own my own family land. It's impossible to get planning because they don't want water of housing. They want everyone in urban areas, and that's certainly a discussion we've been having for a long time. We were speaking earlier about the education system. Caller says, your leaving certs do not define you, which is all very true. Another caller says, it's all very well talking about looking after children in class, but where is the extra help in classes for those children so those who do not need the help can continue to learn and excel? And I think we're getting better in terms of SNA provision and things like that, but there's probably still a way to go with regards to what we can do in terms of supports. Caller says, there's a huge housing crisis in Donegal. I can't understand why the council don't rent houses from developers and at least use them for defective block owners who could use the houses for a 1 or 2 year period. At a time, it would really lessen the burden for those families. That issue certainly has been discussed at the Donegal County Council level. And the council does acquire houses on a regular basis. It's a process called turnkey. And I know there's a number of discussions taking place to increase the number of turnkey houses. Caller asks, does anyone know how many asylum seekers and international protection applicants are in the Letterkenny region at the moment? I don't have those figures to hand, but we'll certainly look into it. Another caller says, I believe someone charging more than €800 for renting a house should have to pay at least twice as much or three times as much tax. That might encourage landlords to keep taxes lower. Now, the issue of health is an issue that comes up on a regular basis. And on the show this week, we heard a number of callers speak about a specific eye clinic in Sligo where people have to go every 6 to 8 weeks for a relatively routine procedure to get an injection. But in the case of one caller from Buncrana, they were called for an interview in Sligo at 5 to 10 in the morning. And they don't have a car, so public transport means that they had to travel the day before, stay overnight in Sligo, and then try and make their way back using public transport. And it was a huge cost. Questions are being asked, why can't we have that service in Letterkenny? Now, certainly some specialised services absolutely have to be done in specialist areas and centres of excellence. But are we at a situation where too much is being centralised into the large centres and we're not getting the full range of services that we could be getting, particularly in our own local hospital here? Hugh Friel, you're the Roma Health Coordinator in Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim. I want to go to you first on this one. I mean, obviously, there's always going to be a debate about access to health and where services are available. There could always be more service provided locally, I'm sure you believe.
Oh, definitely, Greg. And I think it's very difficult for people or individuals like that person who coming from an Ashon area, have an appointment at 9:45 in the morning and have no transport. But that can be exacerbated by not having English as well, like translation issues and being sent appointments and from a real disadvantaged geographical areas of Donegal. If you're down in Aranmore Island, if you're in Dunloe, if you're in Kerrygart, if you're in different parts of the area, was really rural. To get to Sligo is quite a journey at this stage. I don't know what happens in COVID, but there's certainly a lot more cars visual on the road. There's a lot more traffic queues or traffic jams. And where before that it was an hour and a half journey, now can end up to being over 2 hours to go to Sligo, as everybody knows. But I do think that generally that there is specialised clinics in relation to that, and we need specialised doctors and consultants who look at the procedures of what your illness or what your diagnostics is in relation to or diagnosis is. So I think Letterkenny could be a lot better. I think our service could be a lot more user-friendly. I think there's a lot of things wrong in the health system at the moment in relation to accessing appointments in hospitals and what's happening there. Everybody knows the discussion is happening over A&E over the last number of months in terms of waiting lists, in terms of queues, in terms of how long you'd be there. But I do think that there is transport that goes to Galway from Letterkenny Hospital to Galway Hospital. I think there should be some kind of mechanism practice or models used there that people can access transport and the accommodating of the appointments for people in rural areas that don't have that transport or that mechanism of getting to Sligo. They should look at procedures of have you access to transport. So there should be some kind of pre-work done in relation to you as an individual, or a phone call to say, have you access to transport? Have you, will we put the appointment later on the day for you to accommodate where you're coming from? There doesn't seem to be no regard for that.
Brendan Byrne, going to yourself, when you were actively, this discussion is an old discussion. It was going on when you were active in politics, as much, if not more so, than it is today. What's your take on this issue? Are we allowing too much now be centralised in Sligo or be centralised in Galway or Dublin?
There was an interview done by our health minister that wasn't really covered that much in the media, where he spoke in Limerick Hospital recently. And he said, when we do a capacity review and an all-of-hospital assessment, rather than just putting money into hospitals to solve short-term emergencies, you get better results. So if you look at what has brought us to here, by and large, our hospital systems are back to the 1970s, where hospitals were developed, and then we add services to it, we take services from it, but there's no holistic approach. And I remember back in 2018, a former Donegal deputy, Patrick O'Gallagher, called for an assessment and a capacity review of Letterkenny to see what is the potential of what we can deliver, what we're delivering, and how effectively are we delivering things. And it was remarkable that the minister spoke to that point in the last week. So what we have historically here is a system that has ballooned in terms of budgets, in terms of service demand, service needs, and it's still not meeting the needs of the people. So for the last 12 years, as I see it, the solution is pump money in itself. That won't solve it. And I'm glad to hear that the government are now minded to do capacity reviews and assessments of every hospital. And through that mechanism, then such as this injection in the eye for immaculate degenerative order, that there's no reason in the wide world that service cannot be provided as a satellite basis in Letterkenny. But what has happened to get us to this point is that whatever was historically the services in the hospitals, they're either expanded or curtailed or whatever. But there has been no holistic thinking whatsoever, as I see it, in the health service for the last 10 years. But we're at a critical point, because if you look at the basic fact, in the 1970s, our population was 3.2 million in this country, 3.4 million. We're now at 5.2 million and rising by 90 to 120,000 a year. We're going to be a country within 10 to 15 years of 6.5 million people. But our health system is based on a structure that was built in the 1970s. And we've done nothing in terms of capacity building on an individual hospital basis. Until we get back to that, you and I, Donald, are going to be talking about health crises for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
It has to go back to the singular unit of the hospital. And we have to see from there, from the foundation stone to the top floor, what the heck is going on in each hospital?
We know that effectively the sale of the hospital group is now being subsumed into this new regional structure, which is closer to what the Northwestern Health Board would have been back in the day. And Tony Canavan, the erstwhile head of Sailtha, is now head of this new regional health body that is a part of the HSC. We did go through a system where if you put, and it was quite frustrating from our point of view, because if you put a question to the HSC, the answer was, oh, that's a matter for SAILTHA, and you put a question to SAILTHA, the response was, oh, that's a matter for the HSC. Do you think this new regional structure will be able to bridge that gap somewhat and perhaps come up with more joined up thinking?
Absolutely. The closer we get back to the old health board structure, the closer we get back to that point, the better the services will be. But we need to go now from a regional basis to a hospital based capacity assessment. And that's where we need to get to that granular detail, because standing up in the Dáil on budget day saying I'm going to put 24 billion into health is no longer going to solve it. You need to be putting 24 billion into health plus a review of each hospital structure to see where the shortcomings are from a hospital perspective and from a patient and community perspective. And that's the discussion we need to be having. But that dynamic hasn't been in the health debate, as far as I've seen, in the last 10 years. Yet we are here as a country that we are transforming so rapidly as a country. And our services are struggling to play catch up. And this is how basic the equation is broken down. You know, you have to reflect the growth in population, the demographics of each town and each county has changed drastically in the last 20 years.
Emma, you're a person who, all going well, hopefully will be availing of health service for decades and decades and decades to come. I mean, looking at where the health service is now and potentially where it's going, as a younger person, what's your perspective on where we are, in particularly in terms of that the provision of services in the local area? On the one hand, we're told the focus is on primary health centres and have a primary health centre in towns like Newton Cunningham and have primary health centres, keep people away from the hospitals and keep people treated in as close to their own local community as possible. But then on the same token, the same people telling us to do that are telling us, oh, you're going to have to go to Galway, or you're going to have to go to Sligo to get an injection.
Yeah, there definitely has been some positive changes. You know, you have to admire the work done by the primary care centres and, you know, the recent years, the initiative of the Pathfinder Service regarding the elderly and keeping them away from the A&E and the stress that that causes. But I mean, I hope that I can avail of services in my local community and that I don't have to take to the road and travel 2 hours south or further on down to find a central location to find services that really should be provided in Letterkenny University Hospital. You know, if it's not university hospital status, why can we not avail of basic procedures? You know, I'm familiar with a lady that does attend that eye clinic in Sligo and has to do so as frequent as every 4 to 6 weeks and was there yesterday herself, left from a village in, you know, a small town in West Donegal and left at 10:30 yesterday and didn't get back to 8 o'clock yesterday even. And that, as you have spoke to listeners this week, requires somebody to accompany them because of the
you can't drive after the and you can't drive after it, yeah.
Yeah, and she spoke to she spoke to an older lady who has no children of her own, no spouse, and didn't want to be dependent on her nephews or nieces to take her anymore because they needed to take a day off work. So she got the bus down and actually had to call for a taxi to take her home from Sligo. And as it turns out, apparently there's a room set up in Letterkenny Hospital for such procedures, but it comes back down to the same issues again. Staffing.
Yeah.
Cannot get the staff to come to Letterkenny. Maybe initially they may, doctors come to Letterkenny, but then it's nearly a route in to go to a more central location further down the country. Maybe that might be a larger urban setting that might suit their family's needs better. I just see that as part of the, Letterkenny requires into 30 additional extra non-consultant hospital doctors in order to reach the IMO agreement according to the last assessment, and obviously with the moratorium on recruitment and the embargo, that hasn't been fulfilled. So, you know, at every stage, we are understaffed. And I think everyone will say that no matter what services you avail of from LUH. So if they can, you know, find it difficult to provide what's already there, possibly bringing anything new is just not viable. But it should be. Why shouldn't it be? You know, simple procedures like children going for grommets. They have to go down to the ENT services in Sligo. Obviously, people availing of grommets. Grommets are normally young children. So therefore, there's likely to be other children left at home. And that causes other logistical issues for young families.
I always say that doing the 9 till noon show on a Friday, the first hour is the fastest hour of the week, and so it has proved again today. There is so much else we could be discussing, so much else we could be saying, but I'm afraid at this point in time, we have been beaten by time. I want to say a very, very special thank you to all our guests, a special thank you to Emma McGrath. Emma, it's been a pleasure as always, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Donald. Thank you, gentlemen.
Brendan Byrne, as ever, a pleasure. Thank you as well. And Hugh Friel, who is in studio with me. Hugh, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Hugh, as well.
Folks, it's been an interesting discussion. Hopefully we've got some good perspectives out there and we've given our listeners something to think about. Thank you, all three of you, for your perceptions. Going to take a short break. News and obituaries are next.